From the main public broadcasting network, I'm Tom Porter.
I'm Josie Huang, and for Monday, November 23rd, this is Main Things Considered. The state's university system is bracing for layoffs in response to Governor John Baldacci's order to cut state spending by nearly $8 million over the next 2 years.
A correspondence course offered to prison inmates is struggling to meet the demand.
And the challenging effects of hunger in Maine classrooms.
You know, sometimes kids will come in, they'll be laying on the floor, they'll just be like, I'm tired, I'm hungry. So I definitely see it. And when they're feeling like that, it's hard for them to learn.
Those stories and more coming up on Maine Things Considered. First, these headlines.
For MPBN News, I'm Ed Morin. Two more H1N1 deaths are being reported in Maine, bringing to 7 the number of swine flu deaths in Maine since August. State health officials say the latest victims are a Penobscot County resident who was over the age of 65 and a Washington County resident between the ages of 25 and 65. Both died this past weekend. State Health Director Dr. Dora Ann Mills says all the people who have died from swine flu so far in Maine have had underlying medical conditions, some very serious. Mills says in a normal flu season, an estimated 150 people die in Maine. Insurance coverage for mammograms and pap tests will not change in Maine, despite recent national advisories suggesting the testing generally should begin later in life and with less frequency. State Insurance Superintendent Mila Kaufman says new advisories and recommendations do not change Maine's consumer protection standards. She says Maine law is not contingent on advisories from commissions or other groups. The statewide average price of home heating oil in Maine has gone up a penny to $2.57 a gallon after staying at $2.56 for 3 weeks. Kerosene has held steady at $2.95 a gallon. Propane used for domestic heating is up a nickel to a statewide average of $2.71. Maine utility regulators have dismissed a petition by a solar power firm to become an electric transmission utility. The Public Utilities Commission decided today that Grid Solar LLC is a generation facility, not a transmission and distribution utility. PUC Chair Sharon Reichers says the Commission's decision is not a judgment on the merits of commercial-scale solar power or Grid Solar's role in a separate case over a proposed CMP transmission line. Grid Solar opposes that $1.5 billion project. A Maine Tidal Power Company has received $150,000 federal dollars for tidal power testing at the University of Maine. UMaine Mechanical Engineering Professor Mick Peterson says funding from the Department of Energy grant will directly support mechanical engineering graduate students who have been funded by the Portland-based Ocean Renewable Energy Power Company.
The group that's involved in this is from School of Marine Sciences and Mechanical Engineering. So it's very interdisciplinary. We've got fish biologists working with mechanical engineers, which makes for a great combination for tidal energy.
Peterson says they expect to have a significant impact in about a year on the design of the ORPC project and a construction in Eastport. He says tidal energy generation there is about 1 or 2 years down the road. The Maine Department of Conservation has launched an interactive map as the state looks for suitable areas off the coast to test new offshore wind technologies. State geologist Robert Marviny says the map shows the 7 large areas initially under review and the 4 much smaller draft demonstration areas where turbines might be erected. Viewers can also see many of the factors that drove the selection process.
Shipwrecks, seabird nesting islands, sensitive avian habitat, and navigational areas, ferry routes, and things like that.
The University of Maine has received an $8 million grant from the U.S. Department of Energy to set up a test research facility at one site. Marviny has said he hopes there will be 2 or 3 others. Public comments currently are being taken until November 30th on the 4 draft sites. Marviny says a final selection will be made by December 15th. In the weather, light rain along the coast late tonight, becoming mostly cloudy in the north, overcast elsewhere, lows in the low 20s to near 40. Mostly cloudy in the north tomorrow, there's a shower possible in west and central sections. Light rain along the coast comes to an end or tapers to spotty mist, highs 45 to 50. More on the forecast later in the program. For MPBN News, I'm Ed Morin.
This is Maine Things Considered. I'm Josie Huang.
And I'm Tom Porter. Maine's state-funded colleges and universities are preparing for layoffs in response to curtailments totaling nearly $8 million over the next 2 years. The brunt of the impacts announced last week by Governor John Baldacci are expected to be felt during the second half of the budget cycle, at a time when demand for education is expected to be high. A.J. Higgins reports.
Governor John Baldacci's nearly $8 million in cuts to higher education in Maine will hit the institutions hard, but some say it could have been worse.
It's just amazing when we have to look at a $1.7 million cut, and we're thankful that it's not deeper.
John Fitzsimmons, the president of the Maine Community College System, had been told in October to prepare for a reduction of $2.1 million. So when it turned out to be nearly $500,000 less, there was some sense of relief. But Fitzsimmons says the impact of the reductions will be felt during the second half of the state budget cycle that begins July 1st.
Basically losing 240 students, and we would lay off between 20 and 25 faculty, staff, and administrators.
In releasing a curtailment designed to partially address a revenue loss of more than $90 million during the first 5 months of the fiscal year, Governor John Baldacci issued a $63 million curtailment order to immediately cut state spending. The administration is now preparing a supplemental budget for the legislature that is expected to address a projected revenue shortfall of nearly $400 million over the next 20 months. Fitzsimmons says he can only deal with one cutback at a time, and he says it's regrettable that the state is doing less for Maine students at a time when the demand for community college programs is at an all-time high.
We turned away 4,000 students last fall. So we've had, you know, tremendous demand. It's, you know, it's part of it's the popularity of the community college, and the other is the reality of the tough economic times. Mainers have got the message, and they're coming back to school in droves. The problem is they're just queuing up, and there really isn't an answer for them because, you know, we are the lowest tuition in Maine, and either they can get into our place or most of them can't afford going to college, so they have to wait until we're ready.
In addition to the $1.7 million cut at the community college level and a little more than $250,000 reduction to the Maine Maritime Academy's budget, the University of Maine system was forced to absorb a cutback of nearly $6 million.
The positions affected are across the campus. They include the classified professional and faculty positions.
Janet Waldron, Vice President of Administration and Finance at the system's flagship campus in Orono, says UMaine's share of the reduction was about 50%, or just under $3 million. As with the community college system, Waldron says positions at UMaine will not be affected until July.
The stimulus funds that we're receiving certainly will help in terms of holding some of the positions from having to be eliminated mid-year. However, as the curtailment gets translated into an ongoing base reduction in fiscal year 11, then it will definitely have permanent reductions behind it.
Rebecca Weick, Vice Chancellor for Finance and Administration for the university system, says all of the campuses are reevaluating their academic programs, and she says consolidations or eliminations may be unavoidable.
They would all argue that they've been cutting every year for years, just as other public entities have been doing, but they have tried to keep that away from the academic side in the past, and at this point, I think there's really no way to avoid it.
As administrators at the higher education facilities assess their options, educators, including Community College President John Fitzsimmons, say the worst of the cuts may be yet to come when the legislature takes up the governor's supplemental budget in January. For MPBN News, I'm A.J. Higgins.
In an era of budget and program cuts and more demand for social services than ever, one Maine nonprofit is filling an educational niche in an often overlooked place, the prison system. Relying on the generosity of several dozen volunteers, the 10-year-old College Guild program reaches several hundred inmates around the country who might not otherwise have a book to read in segregation. But as Susan Sharon reports, the correspondence program is now struggling under the weight of its own popularity.
College Guild was started on a shoestring budget by former publisher Julie Zimmerman and a friend who were frustrated by the constant interruptions every time they attempted to teach courses in prison.
There might be lockdowns, people needing to go talk to a lawyer, meet with parole boards. It just seemed like that to have a consistent back and forth was really a problem.
So Zimmerman started thinking about what it would be like to offer courses through the mail, especially because she could reach prisoners who were in administrative segregation. Not only that, but she could teach under the radar without having the program accredited and subject to certain rules and regulations, and without interference from prison administration. She wanted courses that were non-traditional, courses that got prisoners to expand their way of thinking.
We wanted courses that were specifically aimed at encouraging creativity and thinking beyond the walls, so to speak. We have a course on dogs, we have one section on potatoes, and we have more serious things. There's one course called Families, which just talks about, for instance, having a child and being a child.
College Guild is designed to reach prisoners of all educational backgrounds in all levels of security settings. Many, probably the majority, dropped out of high school. And Zimmerman says for a large number, English is a second language. So to keep the educational experience positive, the program is not grounded in right or wrong answers or passing or failing. Instead, it relies on a series of questions and writing exercises to provoke a prisoner's imagination. The answers are then mailed back to the Brunswick-based office and distributed to volunteer readers around the country who send back their comments.
Especially because there are so many of these students who haven't had a lot of education, one of my objectives is to try to show them that there are many points of view about every important subject.
Susan Moran of Brunswick is a former history teacher at Tufts University who designed one of the programs for prisoners.
Here's one, and what he has to say about if he were an Israeli. God has finally given back our land. After 2,000 years, we've come back home to the land of Abraham. All my ancestors that have been persecuted, look at us now. God has blessed us, for he has smiled upon his people. Israel is our home. And here's the Palestinian point of view. My people have suffered a great injustice. We've lived on this land, our home, for so many generations. Now our sacred land has been invaded by the Israelis. They are recognized as a nation, while we are treated as nothings by the world. So I guess that kind of thoughtfulness is one of the main things that has reached me in doing this work.
Because there is so little to do in prison, and because prisoners have lost much of the access they historically had to college-based courses, College Guild is especially popular. It doesn't hurt that the course is free for the prisoners. There's now a waiting list of 300. Zimmerman says most of the prisoners are in Texas, who find out about the program through word of mouth. Names of prisoners and readers are kept confidential.
My name is Russell Day. I got involved with College Guild because I became friends with Julie. I sent her some writings of mine a while ago when she was publishing books, and she reviewed some of them and published them. I have a unique perspective in that I was a reader for College Guild, responding to some of these essays that came in, and being a prisoner at the same time.
Day spent 20 years at the Maine State Prison in Thomaston and Warren for the murder of an elderly neighbor. He was released in January and has since found a job, gotten married, and started what he calls paying his debt to society. He no longer volunteers with College Guild, but says it gives prisoners something fundamental.
One of the things I really held on to while I was there was hope. I did not want to become another one of those people that was doing the stereotypical thing, telling the bad jokes, the crude jokes, being involved in the gambling scenes. I wanted to be something better than that. So I really held on to hope, and holding on to that hope kept those dreams alive for me as well.
Day says he was fortunate. At the Maine State Prison, he had access to books and pen and paper. Many inmates around the country do not. Zimmerman would like to replicate College Guild, get more prisoners off the waiting list, and handle more mail, attract more volunteers. But to do that, she says she needs more funding. And she says support for prisoner education programs is low on the priority list, even though it gets to the real meaning of corrections. Tekla Miller is a former prison warden from Michigan who serves on the Guild's board.
Education is the key to success for anybody, particularly prisoners. If they get educated, they'll get a better job, they'll be paying, tax-paying citizens, therefore they'll be citizens and contributing to our community. 90% of these people are coming back.
So who do you want?
Acknowledging the high rate of recidivism for prisoners, Miller says privately her former colleagues wholeheartedly support educational programs in prison, but she says publicly they are reluctant to speak out for fear of looking like they are not tough on crime. Prison, after all, is not intended to be a positive environment. Like Miller, Julie Zimmerman believes there is room for both. While her own program is struggling to keep up with the reams of paperwork sent in from prisons across the country, she says it shows just how desperate inmates are to learn. For MPBN News, I'm Susan Sharon.
Thanksgiving week is a time of overindulgence for many of us. It's not a time to go hungry. But for a growing number of schoolchildren across the country, hunger is a reality, according to a survey released today by Share Our Strength, a national nonprofit working to end childhood hunger.
Too many kids are coming to school too hungry to learn.
Patricia Nicklin is managing director of Share Our Strength.
Fully 62% of teachers that we talked to said that they see children who regularly come to school hungry each week because they're not getting enough to eat at home.
A similar proportion of teachers, meanwhile, report buying food for their students with their own money on a regular basis. Here in Maine, says Nicklin, approximately 14% of households are suffering from what she calls food insecurity, meaning they're considered at risk of not being able to supply food to the family. For school officials in Maine, the challenge is to nourish young bodies effectively while at the same time satisfying the generally unadventurous juvenile palate. It's lunchtime here at Presumpscot Elementary School in downtown Portland. The school has 300 students enrolled, around 200 of whom qualify for food aid, meaning they live in a household which earns less than $3,400 a month. Those from households that earn less than $1,700 a month, meanwhile, can get a free lunch. On the menu this afternoon, a nutritious three-course meal, which Ronald Adams hopes the children will find appealing. It's certainly a healthier offering than you would have seen 17 years ago, he says, when he started working in school nutrition.
We're running lasagna. We have a wheat roll, carrot sticks, apple crisp, choices of milk, and all low-fat milk.
Adams is the food service director for the Portland School District, where nearly 7,000 children are enrolled in public schools, almost 50% of whom qualify for free meals or reduced food aid. The number of students qualifying for some type of food aid has doubled in the past year as the recession takes its toll. It's Adams' job to make sure these kids get the sustenance they need to study and to develop.
The hunger pang can be as little as making the student not pay attention in class. It can, and that's really some of the biggest studies around and go back to how student behavior is, what student learning is all impacted by what they've had either for breakfast or for lunch.
I see kids coming through the door in the morning and they're already hungry.
Rebecca Morano is a kindergarten teacher at Presumpscot School.
Sometimes kids will come in, they'll be laying on the floor, they'll just be like, I'm tired, I'm hungry. So I definitely see it. And when they're feeling like that, it's hard for them to learn.
Morano says she frequently dips into her own pocket to buy food for the kids, as do many of the teachers she knows.
Every time I'm at Sam's Club, I stock up on extras, stick it in the cupboard.
We know that some of our children come in with empty stomachs.
Cynthia Loring is principal at Presumpscot Elementary.
Minds don't function on empty stomachs, so our teachers regularly, all of our teachers, provide keep snacks in their classrooms that they pay for out of their pockets.
In addition to the charity of teachers, however, schools in Maine have for 2 years been offering free breakfasts to all students who qualify for aid. The problem, says school district health coordinator Chanda Turner, is that many students do not arrive at school in time to eat their breakfast. Another challenge, she says, is the cheapness and availability of junk food.
We have one school of kids where I've spoken with the teachers, and the classic snack for those kids was a Snickers bar and a Mountain Dew, because it's so cheap and easy, and the kids like it, and the parents would just send it with the kids. And can you imagine what these kids were like in the classroom after having that as a snack? I mean, there's just no nutritional value to it.
Efforts are being made to combat what Turner describes as an obesity epidemic. Soda and candy vending machines have been absent from Maine schools for several years now, and school lunches have to meet certain nutritional standards set by the government. For example, no more than 30% of the calories provided can come from fat, says Ronald Adams. There's also the Federal Fruit and Vegetable Snack Program, which is now in its second year. 50 schools across the state benefit from nearly $900,000 in USDA funding.
They target it to schools that have at least 50% free or reduced students, and then that pays essentially $50 per student for the year. What we found last year in the first year of this pilot in two schools was that we were able to do it 3 days, 4 days a week.
So instead of Fruit Loops, chips, and candy, try broccoli trees, cold crunchy cucumber, and kiwi halves. It can take a while to train the palate to like these new tastes, says Adams. On average, he says kids need to try a new food about 10 times before their taste buds adjust. Kindergarten teacher Rebecca Morano, though, was pleasantly surprised at how much her students took to the new snacking regime. The program, she says, has made a huge difference to the school.
We get mushrooms, and I looked at the mushrooms, and I'm thinking, these guys are not going to eat them. And the mushrooms and the dip, they ate them all up. The vegetables, the fruits, are eating everything.
Meanwhile, back in the lunchroom, the lasagna and carrots were going down well. But, says kindergartner Nevea Sacco, they're not her favorite food. What's your favorite food?
Cucumbers and salad and pasta salad.
In case you were wondering, her favorite fruit snacks are oranges and bananas. To view the report on hunger in the classroom, visit the website of Share Our Strength, which is strength.org.
It's a weekday night in Portland, and Evie Dupuy is puffing on a cigarette after a long day at art school. Dupuy is 19 and has been smoking since she was 16. She grew up thinking smoking was edgy. She also liked the look of smokers in magazine ads.
Beautiful, like stylish, beautiful clothes, the jewelry, the things that you want. You want that dress, you want those clothes, you want that hair. Why not want the cigarette too? You know, it just tops it off. It's elegant now.
Like many businesses, tobacco companies create ad campaigns for a particular audience. Too successfully, public health advocates say. With smoking rates nationally now stagnating, some advocates are trying to beat tobacco companies at their own game.
So what we're trying to do here is using that same approach, social marketing, to try to tailor the message to quit smoking.
Dr. Nananda Cole is a researcher at Maine Medical Center. She's developed a smoking cessation website specifically for young women. Cole says most anti-smoking campaigns target middle-aged smokers, but smoking poses special problems for young women. 1 in 5 smoke, and those who do have a higher chance of developing osteoporosis. Those who become pregnant face a higher risk of premature deaths. At her office in downtown Portland, Cole demonstrates how the website works.
So I log on to the website, and now what?
And then there's a questionnaire that you can fill out, and it will ask you questions such as, how old are you? Are you a college student? Are you married? How happy have you felt recently? How much do you smoke? And how do you feel when you run out of cigarettes? And you answer those questions, and then you will then see a video.
There are 3 versions of the video, all featuring real-life young female smokers. The particular video you see depends on how you answer the questions. A young woman who, for example, has children and can't seem to kick a serious addiction to cigarettes will be shown this video.
The way I feel when I walk away from my kids to go have a cigarette, I feel like this big. I feel low. Because I'm like, okay, I'm choosing to have a cigarette over playing and hanging out with my kids. That's sad.
Young women working full-time and who tend to smoke because they like it get this advice.
My approach would be to find other hobbies and other ways to distract yourself.
College-educated women, many of whom smoke socially and may not even consider themselves to be smokers, watch this version.
Sit down in the mirror and have a chat with yourself about why you should stop smoking and really, really make a good list so you can't justify having another cigarette later.
Dr. Cole says targeting anti-smoking messages based on a woman's motivation for smoking and the barriers to her quitting is much more effective than using a one-size-fits-all approach.
For instance, if some women are not smoking because of the social aspect, there's no point in talking about that. For the women who are young mothers, they want to quit. So those kinds of women, you don't need to motivate them to quit. What you need to do is really just help them, give them tools, give them resources, give them nicotine patches.
About 100 women in Maine have used the website as part of a trial. Researchers will check back with the women after a few months to see if the videos have had any impact on their smoking habits. Catherine Saverell tried the website a couple months ago.
I liked that the video had people my age that I could really identify with.
Saverell is a 24-year-old college-educated Mainer now working as a research assistant in New York. Like some of the women in the video she saw, she considers herself a very light smoker. but she still wants to stop smoking completely and says it helps to see others talk about their motivations for quitting, such as the risk of cancer.
There's also concerns about wrinkling and smelling bad and those sort of things that I think about too.
The website hasn't been officially launched to the public, but MaineMed is providing previews. To learn more, log on to our website at www.mpbn.net.
Well, it's 1 minute to six. Let's have a quick look at the weather forecast. Light rain along the coast late tonight, becoming mostly cloudy in the north, overcast elsewhere, lows in the low 20s to near 40. Mostly cloudy in the north tomorrow, a shower possible in the western and central sections, light rain across the coast coming to an end or tapering to a spotty mist. Mild, highs 45 to 50. Mostly cloudy and mild statewide Wednesday, highs in the upper 40s to low 50s. Mostly cloudy on Thanksgiving with a few showers possible, highs 44 to 52. And on Friday, a powerful nor'easter expanding across Maine, bringing wind, rain and fog. The hills and mountains will eventually get snow. Highs upper 30s to upper 40s.
And that's Maine Things Considered for this Monday. We had production help from Keith Shortall and Barbara Caridi. I'm Josie Huang.
And I'm Tom Porter. Thanks for listening.